and only a door remained between me and Sean. 2 long years plus change had passed since I'd last seen him. I paused again and closed my eyes as Raiden's words from long ago floated up in my mind. Words I hadn't heeded. And suddenly, I was back in his office of glass, staring down at Sean, and Raiden was saying,
"If you don't tell Sean that Cruz is fucking you while you sleep, it will destroy what you have with him more certainly than any job in my club could. That, down there."
He pointed to Sean, serving a drink to a pretty, nearly naked Seely.
"Is a bump in the road, a test of temptation and fidelity. If your Sean loves you, he will pass it with flying colors. Cruz is a test of your fucking soul."
He'd also said,
"Your god may love soulmates, but man does not. Such a couple is vulnerable, particularly if they are fool enough to let the world see how shiny and happy they are. Their risk rises tenfold during times of war. There are two courses a couple in such circumstances can chart. Go deep into the country and hide as far from humanity as possible, hoping like hell nobody finds them, because the world will tear them apart, or sink up to their necks in the stench and filth and corruption of their war-torn existence. See things for what they are. Drop your blinders and raise the sewer to eye level. Admit you're swimming in shit. If you don't acknowledge the turd hurtling down the drain toward you, you can't dodge it. You have to face every challenge together, because the world will tear you apart."
"Right on both counts, Raiden," I thought with a sad smile. I should have listened. But I'd been ashamed, afraid. It had been utterly against my will, but I'd enjoyed it. What does a woman do with that? I'd told myself over the years that it wasn't my fault. I'd been used at the hands of the most powerful Fae prince in existence. Who could make me think I was feeling anything? Still, the shame. I'd never wanted another man inside me but Sean, yet I'd hungered for Cruz in a way I'd never hungered for Sean. Even if that was an illusion he'd forced upon me, I could still taste the memory of it. And I hated Cruz for that. I knew why Sean was angry. I knew why he was bitter. We know each other's every gesture, every twitch, pain, fear, hope, and dream. A deception lived and breathed between us. And it had taken on a dark, rapacious life of its own. If I was to have any hope at all of helping him become the man I believed he could be, he wasn't the only one that needed to face his demons today. Inhaling sharply, I squared my shoulders and pushed open the door, praying there was validity to the adage, "And the truth will set you free."
"Why have you come, Kat?"
Sean said, in a low, angry voice without turning. He stood on the far side of the circular stone chamber, framed in a tall, narrow opening cut into the stone, the wind gusting waist-length black hair around his body, ruffling the feathers of enormous raven wings.
"Leave. Now. There's nothing for you here."
If I'd not seen Christian first and felt his heart, Sean would have terrified me. My love was once a handsome, rugged fisherman, toiling on the ocean, having turned his muscled from pulling nets all day back on the mighty, deadly O'Banion clan. With his black hair, dark eyes, and quick, easy smiles, I'd learned to trust him in that frightened, wide-open state in which I'd spent my earliest years. Of all the people I'd met, his had been the only heart that rang true to me. Void of complicity. Despite his appearance, nearly identical to Christian and Cruz, he didn't frighten me now. I could feel him. I was close enough. He was lost within, drifting in a land far more barren and wasted than what spread so ugly and black beyond these castle walls. His sociopathic cousin, Rocky O'Banion's credo, inscribed on the back of a watch of gold and diamonds he always wore, had been, "Isolate the mark." He'd sworn that every man and woman, regardless of education, pedigree or wealth, would ultimately fall prey to it, that we couldn't stand alone. Yet Sean had been perched in dangerous isolation for 2 years and hadn't succumbed. That gave me hope. "I disagree," I said, moving farther into the icy room. "You're here."
"I may be, but Sean is not,"
he said bitterly.
"He's been gone a long time."
"I don't believe you." When he whirled in a storm of dark feathers and flashing alien eyes, I inhaled sharply, but stood my ground. "My love," I thought. "Oh, my love, I'm so sorry." Both born into powerful Irish crime families, we'd spent our entire lives running from the darkness of our own blood. But the darkness had found him. I hazed the vision of my eyes, the better to focus the gaze of my heart.
"Get out, Cat. I don't want you here. You're nothing to me,"
he said coldly.
"Less than nothing. And don't bloody do that to me. You don't want to feel it. Leave now, and I'll let you live."
If I was nothing, why then was the image frozen in his heart of the day I'd insisted he accept me and my child without knowing? The day I'd erected an impenetrable wall between us and shut him out? I blurted in a swift rush of words, because I knew I'd never get it out otherwise, that truth. That terrible, divisive truth that had been eating me alive inside and cut the ties that bound us. "I lied, Sean. I lied to you. Cruz came to me while I slept. He raped me in my dreams. Ray might be his." I began to weep the instant it was out. I felt as if an enormous pressure, constantly crushing me, had vanished from my soul. I wept with relief. I wept with sorrow. I wept with confliction because I love Ray. I love her with all my heart, and she might be my enemy's child. What do you do with that? Sean jerked violently, shuddering from head to toe with the intensity of his emotion. Raven-veined ice exploded in the room, sheeting the floor, climbing the stone walls, dripping from the ceiling in dark crystal stalactites. His voice was deafening when he exploded.
"Cruz raped?"
He broke off, unable to finish the sentence, jerking violently, hands fisting.
"That son of a bitch! That son of a fucking—"
He trailed off, snarling, body straining from the effort to control himself. With a mere emotion, he turned the room into a cave of dark ice. I shivered, crying silently, but stood my ground. He wouldn't ice me. Not my Sean.
"Fuck, Cat,"
he cried then.
"Fuck! Why didn't you tell me?"
"I'm so sorry," I said, voice breaking. "I wanted to tell you, but I was so ashamed. And the longer I didn't tell you, the longer it went on, the less possible it became." I didn't say that I felt complicit. I couldn't begin to explain how trapped it had made me feel. Not without telling him why, that I'd also felt pleasure from it. "You hadn't begun to change. You were a man. He was a prince. How could you have battled Cruz? What if he'd killed you?"
"I thought she was Castellos."
His voice broke.
"I thought you cheated on me with one of the nine."
"Och, no, Sean. I was pregnant before that. Didn't you do the math?"
"She could have been early."
"She wasn't. Castello taught me to shut out the pain of the world. He taught me to become strong, but never—" I broke off, shaking my head violently. "Castello's heart belongs to someone else. Not me. Never me. And my heart has always belonged to you. I love you, Sean. It's always been you. Don't you remember what we promised each other?
That was then. Before I became the monster I am, you'd never have pledged such a troth to what I've become. I'm what raped you.
If you weaken, I'll be strong, I said through tears. It was the first line of the vow we'd taken together when we were young, the day we'd run off to Paradise Point by the lighthouse, dressed up as if it were our wedding day, had our own ceremony, pledging our hearts and souls together. Too much passion burns, tenderness fuses. We'd always been tender with each other, and that passion we shared was rich and good and strong. Until a fey prince had shattered it with lust inflated by illusion, and made me compare. Never compare. The moment you do, you destroy what gifts you possess, and your gifts are precious. Let me be strong for you now. He spun then, gave me his back, and turned to stare out at the stormy lashing sea.
It's too late, Cat. Far too late for that.
I refused to believe that. If you get lost, I'll be your way home, I said softly.
Go away. I'm not the man you used to know. There's nothing left of him, and I have no bloody home.
I shook my head as I wiped tears from my cheeks. Sean was not staying lost within his ugly, horrible place, in this ugly, horrible land. Nor was he leaving alone to go God knew where. The cat I'd once been would have quailed before such a creature. That looked so much like Cruz. The woman I'd been before Castillo wouldn't have been able to handle the waves of pain, misery and self-loathing gusting from Sean's soul, slamming into me, icy spears piercing my heart, trying to destroy my hope. But I'd learned. Locked beneath Chester's by Riordan, trapped with one of the nine, I'd learned what I needed to know in order to fix the problem I'd made by failing to heed Riordan's warnings in the first place. I wasn't the woman I'd once been. And I was angry now, too. Riordan had so clearly warned me that the world destroyed soulmates. I'd not only refused to listen, I'd helped the world do it. I'd been the one to divide us. And I would, by God, put us back together. If you despair, I'll bring you joy, I said, speaking the third line of our vows. Do you hear me? Sean O'Banion, joy. You're going to feel it again. You don't believe it now, but you will. We took those vows for a reason. We made them up together, carefully paring it down to what was most important to us. We did it because we knew the taint of our own blood was strong. We knew one day we might slip. We knew how much pressure they put on us to be like them, how treacherous and sly they were. How they liked to tempt, ridicule, and bully us. We vowed to never let one another fall without helping each other stand back up and find our way. You're going to stand back up. You're going to fight what's been done to you. I'm going to fight it with you, with everything I've got. I vow that I will never again give you anything but truth. And one day you will take those vows with me again, and one day you will say that last line again, and you'll bloody well mean it, and that's what we'll use to contain the darkness within you.
It's not that simple, Cat,
he growled.
You have no bloody clue what kind of monster you're dealing with.
You say that to the woman who was raped by one like you, and flown here by another like you. I know exactly what you are. My Sean in trouble. But not alone. Never alone again.
It's not possible. I've tried. Bloody hell, have I tried? I'm not Christian. I'm not that strong. He came from a line of pure hearts. I come from a corrupt bloodline.
Christian had clan who loved him, who'd fought for him, fought alongside him. Sean had no one, His entire family was dead, and I'd let him slip away into darkness, the thing I'd vowed never to do. When had I stopped believing in us? I knew the answer to that. When I'd begun to brick and mortar a wall of shame and lies between us. When Riordan had warned me that we were in peril. Argue for your limitations, you make them yours. Together we're going to argue for your possibilities. It's entirely possible Rey is your child, if you still want that paternity test. That might give me a foothold, get him turned back toward the world again, and perhaps the test would be positive for Sean, and perhaps it would be inconclusive if she were Cruz's. Perhaps whatever passed as Fae DNA didn't register, and inconclusive wasn't quite so troubling. Human hearts are funny that way. We let ourselves believe gentle lies. But it would be his choice this time, not me keeping the truth from him. A tremor ran through his body, ruffling his wings. He said nothing for a long time. Then...
What are the odds?
50-50, I told him flatly, stung by the thought he believed I might have taken other lovers. There's never been anyone but you, and against my will, him. You've never met Rey, Sean. You should. She's lovely, with your hair and eyes. Fun-filled, good and loving. That doesn't sound like Cruz to me. Still, she has one of two fathers, you or him. Either way, she has an unseely prince for a da. Cruz is dead, I hoped. You're not. Wouldn't you rather my daughter, and quite possibly yours as well, grow up knowing you as her father, not him? He turned then and looked at me, with a glimmer of emotion in his eyes, and I inhaled sharply. Deep within, I could feel a faint, weak stirring of hope. For 2 long years, no one had come for him. Perhaps he thought I knew where he was, what he was doing, and had chosen not to come. I had no idea where you were or what had happened to you, I said, fanning the flame of that hope. I thought you didn't care anymore. I thought you'd left because you despised me. I missed you, Sean. God, I missed you more than words can say. I closed my eyes as a fresh burn of tears stung them. How many times had I imagined me and Rey walking the fields near the Abbey with Sean? Being a family, no matter whose child she was. Cooking a meal of fresh-caught fish, watching the stars come out, tucking her in, making love until dawn. Give us one more chance, Sean, I begged. Please, say you'll try. 29. There is a castle on a cloud. Some days Dublin is so beautiful it slays me. And this morning was one of those days, as Riordan and I hurried down cobbled streets toward Baron's Books and Bubbles. An overnight driving rain had left puddles as still and glassy as mirrors on the pavement, reflecting buildings and shops and sky. Everything was glistening wet, scrubbed clean, gilded by streaks of sunshine slicing through clouds. It was one of those startlingly crisp mornings, done in vivid greys and blacks and silvers, splashed with colourful flowers blooming in planters and trees dotting the curbs. Riordan had asked me to narrow down the time frame of the bookstore's disappearance, but I wasn't able to give him better than a 2-week window. It had been that long since I'd last passed by before discovering it gone, which meant it may have vanished 2 weeks before, or that same day, the day before he'd shattered my door. We crisscrossed the lots repeatedly, searching for clues, staring down, gazing up, poking in the few bits of debris rolling like tumbleweeds across concrete. Aside from an impression of unnatural distortion, there wasn't a single enlightening bit of evidence to be found. The mystery of Baron's Books and Baubles had donned the equivalent of that woman's battle dress. I've got nothing, I told Riordan a few minutes later, when we met up where the stately, transomed front entrance had once been.
This makes no sense,
he murmured, as a text alert sounded on his phone. He removed it from his pocket, read it, and frowned. Another alert went off, and he grabbed my heavily sleeved and gloved arm while reading it, and began tugging me across the lot toward the alley. What? Where are we going? I demanded.
Just come.
You don't have to drag me, I growled.
I'm not so sure about that.
He was dashing me along so quickly, I barely had time to register where we were heading. But I did, and dug my heels in instantly. Oh no, hell no, I'm not losing time again. My city needed me now, not months or years later. Shazam needed me. He gave a sharp jerk, and I went stumbling forward, plunging into the wall behind Baron's books and baubles, into that precise portal I'd once entered so long ago, then spent endless years Silverside, trying to get back home. I squished into the wall. Then I was the wall. Then I squirted out the other side, into the infamous white room, which still lacked tired starlings, where I stood scowling ferociously at 10 enormous mirrors, one of which had so nefariously dumped me into the ancient, inimical Hall of All Days a lifetime ago. I blinked. The white room had changed. It was no longer a completely blank, featureless room. Someone had redecorated. Or, like everything else in the world, it had been treated to a magical upgrade. Ornate white moldings crowned the walls, melting into a lavishly transcendent ceiling from which a dozen chandeliers hung, glittering like ice in the sunlight. The walls were wainscoted from floor to ceiling, with ornately embellished panels. The floor was glossy white marble. The mirrors, however, were exactly the same, hanging without visible means of support, some twirling lazily within elaborate frames, others motionless, in thin, welded chain-link borders. A few of the looking glasses were black as night, some milky, others swirling with unnerving shadows. They'd once again been shuffled. I really hated this room. When Riordan appeared beside me, I said crossly, I am not going back into the White Mansion or the Hall. I don't care what your reasons are.
Baron's texted. He wanted us off site quickly so we'd stop drawing attention to it.
Baron's? I exclaimed. Where is he?
We're going to him now.
I inhaled deeply, girding myself. I was all in wherever he was, but I had unpleasant memories of this place. Going through a mirror and getting lost for years. Coming out chased by the Crimson Hag and killing Riordan and Barons. More recently, going in to save Mac, returning to an entirely different Dublin, and a deeply angry dancer. I'd lost weeks I hadn't gotten to spend with him, and bloody hell, if I'd known our time together was going to be so short. Well, the truth was, I'd still have gone in, because it was necessary, and that's what I do. Still, I'd lost so much time in my life.
We won't be losing time now,
Riordan said.
We're using a different stack of silvers that bypass the White Mansion completely.
When he pushed into the third mirror from the left, a silver I'd never entered before, I rolled my eyes, shook my head, and plunged in behind him. After a long, twisting, unpleasant stretch of myself through whatever the silvers are made of, I stumbled out. I swear the mirrors do that on purpose to you, to keep you off balance, into the heart of Barons, books, and baubles. I just stood there a moment, glowing quietly, Harry Potter reunited with Hogwarts. I was in my magical place again where I'd once felt, so long ago, for the first time ever, that I might just belong somewhere. The place holds a sacred, mystical ambiance for me. I love BB&B. Love, love, love it. It smells of high adventure, bound in leather casings, crammed on shelves waiting to be freed. Of Mac's peaches and cream candles. Of Baron's fine furnishings and wool rugs. And the spice of my kind of danger. The sounds of this store are music to my soul. The tinkling of the front doorbell, which I intended to bang at least once while I was here. The soft hiss of a gas fire in an enameled hearth. The quiet hum of the fridge behind Mac's counter. Mac! I couldn't wait to talk to her. I had so much to tell her, so much to ask. I turned slowly, drinking it all in. The elegant furnishings, the way the sun slanted through the leaded glass windows. My beloved build door. The strings of coloured lights draping the bookcases. The stockings hung on the mantel. The tall, decorated Christmas tree in the corner. Wait, what? Had we lost time after all? It wasn't December.
Why the bloody hell do you have a Christmas tree up, Barons?
Riordan growled behind me. I spun and caught my breath, smiling. Jericho Barons is one of the few constants in my world. Other things might change, but Barons never does. He's impervious, immutable. A giant, obdurate stone of a man that not even water can carve. Like Riordan. His nostrils flared, and a tiny muscle worked in his jaw.
I don't. That was Mac's idea. At least it's not pink this time.
A flash of movement caught my eye on a tall bookcase behind him. Barons, why is there a lemur in your store? His face could not have gone darker.
Mac's idea, too.
What are you feeding him? Was he feeding him? The little guy looked awfully lean to me.
If I could catch the furry fuck, I'd throw him out the bloody window. He's been shitting everywhere. You have black flames on your face, Danny. What has Riordan been doing to you? He knows better than to tattoo the face when there's body left.
He shot Riordan a questioning look then, and something passed between them I didn't understand. Riordan jerked his head once. Barons nodded. They were having an utterly private conversation. Years ago, I'd have ignored them. I didn't, this time. I wondered if I could push in. Like I had at Illyrium. I stared into Riordan's eyes, letting mine shift out of focus, and thought about the tattoo he'd inked at the base of my spine. About his blood and mine intermingled, and the dangerous power of such spells, the inadvertent connections they forged. I emptied my brain of thought, expanded my senses, and... wham!
Don't bloody have any idea. Think she's turning into a hunter.
Shock and a deep undertow of sorrow.
Christ! Of all the things you guessed, that was never one of them. What are you doing here? She didn't call IISS, or I'd have known. You aren't supposed to be here. I know. How did you get back? I told you. No bloody clue. One moment I was there, the next I was... Stop that!
They both snarled at once. I staggered from the force with which they'd ejected me from their thoughts.
You were only in his head, not mine.
Barons shot me a dark look.
I felt you in his head, and you heard me there, so don't get all cocky about it.
I arched a brow, feeling pretty cocky anyway. I'd pushed into Riordan's impenetrable head. Damn. Aloud, I said, where are we? And how did you know we were in the lot?
I glanced out the window.
Stymied, I was headed for the door to accomplish two objectives, bang that bell, and see where we were, when Barons thundered,
Don't open it!
I caught him a startled look and went to the window instead. I stared, blinked, stared again. BB&B was resting in the middle of fluffy white clouds, with a narrow view through them to the empty lots below. It was sunny up here, gloomy below. I pressed my cheek to the window and thought, Holy Romulan cloaking device. This store was invisible from the outside. Good grief! We're in the movie Up. What did you do? How did you float BB&B? If I'd walked out the door, I'd have plunged. Don't you dare toss that poor little lemur out, I added worriedly.
I didn't float it, Mac did.
I glanced around, dying to see her. This was turning out to be a banner day. Riordan, Barons, and Mac. My lions, tigers, and bears had returned. Where is she? I asked eagerly.
That's what we need to discuss,
Barons said grimly. The Fae had never had any intention of accepting Mac as their new queen, Barons told us as we gathered in the rear seating area of the bookstore on Mac's favorite Chesterfield sofa. Infuriated by the discovery that their past queen, who'd forcibly removed them from the human realm long ago, had begun her existence as a human, compounded by the discovery that their trusted Seelie Prince Villain was actually an un-Seelie Prince? The Light Court had gone hardcore purist. Only a Seelie would be permitted to lead in the future. Only a Seelie would become the next royalty. Thus committed, they'd put a high price on Jane's head, determined to kill him so the next prince born would be one of their own.
There are now two Light Court princes that are full-blooded Fae,
Barons told us.
They conceal their presence from you.
One, I corrected. I killed one last night. Barons arched a brow.
You ignored Mac's decree.
We had no choice. You left and never said a word. We had no idea if you were even still alive, I said flatly.
No thanks to the Fae. They demanded she come to court, rolled out the bloody red carpet. For a few days they played nice, feigning willingness to accept her. Gratitude that she'd repaired the world and destroyed the Unseelie. But their ancient powers were being reinvigorated by the song. After 4 days in Faerie, meeting with every caste, giving Mac no time to try to learn how to access the power the Queen passed to her, the attacks began. 42 attacks on her life in 12 hours.
He growled, dark eyes flashing. They came after her, even though she has the spear and you at her side? I said incredulously. Are they nuts?
Stealth attacks in large numbers, trying to separate us. They were willing to die to see one of them take her place. We needed time. A queen who can't use her power is no queen at all. We returned to Dublin. I stacked silvers and took her to a chamber I know in the White Mansion. The first room the Unseelie King built for his concubine, long before the White Mansion came to be. A chamber where time moves so slowly it doesn't even crawl. A day in our world is decades there. Best guess, she's been sitting in that room for nearly a century. And you? How long have you been sitting here?
Riordan demanded.
Irrelevant.
Why are you here if she's in the White Mansion? I asked. Barons would never leave Mac alone unguarded.
She's not. She moved things. I was in the White Mansion, outside the chamber, keeping guard. Abruptly, I found myself in the bookstore with her chamber connected to it by a door that didn't exist before.
He gestured over his shoulder at a door to the right of the enameled fireplace in the rear conversation area.
Perhaps she sensed a threat approaching and moved us. Then things began to appear, change. Be glad you didn't come the day she turned everything pink. If you never see a bloody, tufted pink Chesterfield, count yourself lucky. She's testing her powers, seeing what she can do. The lemur should vanish soon. Most of it does.
Is she eating, drinking, doing anything? I asked. God, I just wanted to see her. So many times over the past few years I'd hungered to talk to her. Now especially with Riordan back. Me and Mac are a lot alike, yet at the same time couldn't be more different. She gets emotion, but doesn't always get logic. We're yin-yang, and good for each other that way.
No, not only does time pass very differently there, I doubt she needs to anymore. She's turning Fae. I opened the door, once. The temporal clash nearly killed me. When's the last time you ate?
Riordan demanded.
Too long. Go. I'll remain.
Barons sliced his head in negation.
You don't look good. We make our own choices, don't we? We don't listen to the counsel of others. How did that work out for you? For fuck's sake, let it go. We argued about it then. It seemed the wisest option at the time, and you know it.
Riordan said coolly.
Time. That's always the problem, isn't it?
I had no idea what they were talking about once again, but silently I agreed. Not enough time with Dancer. Now not enough with Riordan before my body had become lethal to the touch. Riordan glanced at me. I didn't even need him to open his mouth to know what he was going to say. Just go, I said irritably. Have your Alpha 9 catch-up time. I need to do some research anyway. To Barons, I said. Books on the old Earth gods. Point me to them. He did, and as they headed back to Barons' office, I loped upstairs in the general direction of the lemur, who'd just swung up over the balustrade to educate myself on our new, ancient enemies. They say that those who forget their past are condemned to repeat it. What then are those who erase their past condemned to do? Be devoured by it? Destroy all hope of a future? Because that's pretty much what had happened to our past. A giant eraser had been taken to it. The Celts were known for not writing things down. Ours was an ancient oral tradition. Then the Romans had come along and plastered their god names over ours. And if that hadn't obfuscated our origins enough, Christianity stormed in and pasted yet more names, images, and legends over our gods until we were left with little more than the likes of leprechauns, diminutive, mischievous fairies, and trolls. We're a stubborn people, we Irish. We don't go down easily. The only way Christianity had been able to eradicate our history so completely was by eradicating churches on our sacred sites, obscuring their origin and purpose, and renaming our pagan feast days, transforming them into Christian celebrations with none of our traditions behind them. Our gods were a hot mess of slanted, rewritten press. I read for hours, and instead of discovering answers, found yet more questions. The Fomorians had been stirred in with the Fae, blended with deities from all over Western Europe, and many allegedly defeated or converted by various saints. Saint Patrick was credited not only with driving all snakes out of Ireland, when scientific study conclusively supported that Ireland had never even had snakes to begin with, but meeting with gods from our past, and after long discourse converting even them to Christianity. In other words, our history was shit. God names and the Tuatha De Danann names had become largely interchangeable. Oh yeah, erase that monument to whatever we did that was terrible, so it can bite us in the ass in the future. What goes around comes around if you're foolish enough to let it. That's why I remember every single thing I've done. Stare at myself in a mirror and meet those eyes that have screwed up, fully aware of my failings, because the day I let myself forget them is the day I could start doing them all over again. Never going to happen. I pilfered Barons's bookstore, gathering up tomes for further reading, jotting names in my notepad on my phone, from Abertoch to Baylor, Morgan to Loch, Dagda and Ain, Meb and Dara, sketchy scant notes about each. I couldn't find a single mention of Oz or a human abducting god anywhere. As I was scowling down at my phone, it abruptly turned pink, exploded in sparkling hearts all over the screen, obliterating my notepad, replacing it with a flowery script. I'm getting there, Danny. Be back soon. Miss you. Love you so much. Mac. I smiled from ear to ear, then burst out laughing. Pink and hearts. Mac was still Mac, despite turning fey. Mac would always be Mac. She'd been through so much, survived possession by the greatest evil known to man or fae, defeated the enormous psychopath sentience that had consumed her. Fae knowledge and power would never obliterate Barons's rainbow girl. There was no way to text her back, and the note vanished, but I was quick enough to snap a screenshot of the message before it disappeared. A memento. A promise. Right up there with a pinky swear. I glanced out the window at the darkening sky, gathered up the books I was taking with me, and went downstairs to find bags to toss them in. I was rummaging behind the cash register when Barons and Riordan walked in. Barons took one look at my books and growled.
Those were in a locked case.
Duh. I'm the one that took them out. Dark eyes bored into mine.
No way you picked that lock.
I know, right? I replied crossly. I'm a superb lockpicker. It's one of my specialties, and the damn thing had defeated me. I broke the glass with the hilt of my sword.
You broke The glass.
Good grief. Mac told me Baron's got pissy when you messed with his stuff. You may as well know I took your bike and Land Rover too, before the garage disappeared. I informed him, just to clear the air between us. He stared at me as if I were a specimen on a slide. Mac texted, I said to distract him. She's okay. He went preternaturally still. So motionless, he vanished from my sight for a moment, melting into the wallpaper behind him. Then he was back, saying softly,
She texted. You. Let me see it.
Ow. I guess she hadn't bothered to text him. Just sent him Christmas trees and lemurs. I handed him my phone with the screenshot thumbed up. He stared at it a long moment, shadows swirling in his dark eyes, and I saw a flash of such pure, unguarded hunger in them that it staggered me. Theirs is unity, a symbiosis, a partnership I dream of. Wolves that chose to pack up and hunt together. Soldiers who will always have each other's backs no matter what. No sin, no transgression too great. He ran his thumb over the screen, as if he might somehow touch Mac through it, and I thought, holy hell, Jericho Barons has a... not a vulnerability, but... yes, that. A weakness, a need. Mac. I'd seen it in her, too. It was what bothered me about love. Wanting someone so much that you felt like you couldn't breathe when they went away. So intensely that your world lost half its colors and you were oddly suspended until they returned. Like my past 2 years. Vulnerability, any way you looked at it. I glanced uneasily at Riordan, then quickly away. Losing Shazam had nearly destroyed me. Losing Dancer had taken me down again. Then Baron's face was remote, cool and unreadable. He pivoted sharply, stalked to the rear fireplace, rummaged about on the mantel, then returned and handed me my phone back, along with an envelope.
Mac asked me to give you this when I next saw you.
I took it, a sealed white envelope with no writing on it. What is it?
I have no idea. She merely asked me to make sure you got it.
I wanted to tear it open right then. I didn't. I would look at it later, in private.
Aren't you going to open it?
He demanded. If it's anything to do with Mac, I'll text you. He inclined his head.
And the moment she comes out, I'll let you know. Until then, give the bookstore a wide berth. Draw no attention to us. The Fae haven't found her yet, and I intend to keep it that way.
I nodded. Feed the lemur. Surely you have food in here somewhere. At least put a bowl of water out. Poor little guy had sat on a bookcase above my head the entire time I'd read. He was lonely and hungry. I tucked the envelope in my pocket, packed my books in BB&B bags, and Riordan and I left, pushing back into the mirror, returning to dusk-cloaked Dublin below. Later, I sat at what remained of my dining room table, sans several leaves, with my books spread out, the envelope from Mac in my hand. Shazam was nowhere to be seen, but last night he'd promised to hang around more. I was counting on that. He was the only living thing I could hug. Riordan had been adamantly opposed to me returning to my flat, but I'd insisted, reminding him of the stellar warding job he'd done on my bedroom, affording me a place safe from the Fae. If he had his way, I'd be living at Chester's. Nothing new there. He'd been trying to effect that change of residence since I was a kid. I wasn't a kid anymore. I was a woman who'd grown accustomed to her own space and time. I'd agreed to meet him at Chester's after I investigated whatever was in the envelope from Mac, and spent a few more hours with Barons's ancient tomes. I turned the envelope over, stripped off my glove and opened it, withdrawing two sheets of paper and unfolding them. My breath jammed up in my throat, and all I could think was, what the bloody hell? How had Mac gotten a letter from Dancer? I closed my eyes, evened my breathing, braced myself for grief, and began to read.
Hi, Mega,
Hi, Dancer, I whispered.
I love you.
I love you too.
I thought I'd say that first, so I didn't start right off with an ominous cliché like, if you're reading this, I'm dead. But if you are, I am. Don't worry about me. I'm fine, and we'll see each other again. I wanted to leave you a letter, but I couldn't think of a place to leave it that A, you wouldn't find it before I was dead, and B, you'd definitely find it after I was, and honestly, I didn't want you to have it right away. So I asked Mac to give it to you when the time seemed right. I know my death will hit you hard, and I'm so bloody sorry about that. I've suspected for a while the cosmic clock is winding down for me. I know the signs. You know them too. And I love you to the ends of the earth and back again for ignoring them with me. That took more than courage, Mega. That took a heart of gold and a backbone of steel. I used to worry that I'd never get to hold you and make love to you in this lifetime. That our red thread was going to have to be a platonic one because you were so young when we met and I had an impaired heart and it drove me crazy because I knew we'd loved each other before. I knew it the moment I saw you spitting fex a million miles a minute, feeling everything in life so intensely. Google the red thread of a Japanese myth. If the internet doesn't work, look in my photo album. The brown leather one, with all the selfies we took together when we were having crazy stupid fun, along with those other selfies where we were doing crazy sexy things. I love you for those. Best porn ever. So anyway, I printed out the myth for you, in case the world stays offline. But in brief, the Japanese believe our relationships are predestined by gods who tie together the pinky fingers of those who are supposed to find each other in life. People connected by red threads will have a profound impact on one another. Life-changing, soul-shaping impact. They'll make history together. Although those threads can get tangled, knotted and snarled, they're unbreakable. As an aside, I think it's best not to take the unbreakable part for granted. Choice is paramount. Red threads are sacred. Be gentle with them. As another aside, those red threads shoot out from our pinky fingers because the ulnar artery runs from the heart to the little finger, and those threads are there to keep our hearts connected across space and time. Thank you for being my red thread. I know how damned lucky I was to get you. I know you, wild thing, much better than you think. You thought I loved you because I only saw the good parts of you. You thought I saw you through a filter. I didn't. I know about the cage. I hate her for that more than you can know. The killing you were tricked into doing. I hate Rowena, too. The terrible injustices you suffered. Yet, you came out of it with a heart so pure, it takes my breath away. If I could, I'd have saved you 1,000 times over. I'd have been your knight in shining armor. I'd have slayed dragons, rescued you, fought wars for you. But no one saved you, so you saved the world. And now I'm dead, and I left you alone, and I hate that. You remember when I asked you about Raiden? You got mad at me when I said I wasn't as super as him. You said that I was just as super, just not in the same ways. Thank you for saying that. I view you the way you view Raiden. I worship you. I'm in awe of you. I think you're the most amazing person I've ever known. I envied Raiden, his strong heart, his immortal body. I envied his long life so much I nearly hated him. Then one day he came to me, after you told him I was dying. He told me about you, the things you never let me know. He didn't tell me everything, so don't get mad at him. I know because I asked questions he wouldn't answer. He wanted me to know what a miracle you are. He was also taking my measure, trying to decide if I was worthy of you. My respect and esteem for you grew even greater that day, and I hadn't thought it possible. You're a one-in-a-Googleplex kind of woman, Mega. Before he left, he offered to get me the elixir of life. When I said no, he offered to make me like him.
I dropped the letter and sat staring blankly. He'd done what? I'd asked him to do that very thing. He'd said no, it wouldn't work, it might kill him. Then he'd gone to Dancer and offered to do it anyway. For me. I spent several long moments trying to process that, then resumed reading.
He said it wasn't a guaranteed success. My heart might blow anyway. I might not survive the transformation. But because you loved me, he would try. He said neither the elixir nor becoming like him was without price. Both came accompanied by significant problems. He said he would tell me those problems if I chose one of the options. I've never been so tempted in my life. But there's a pattern and purpose to all things. I see it in the sublime truth of math. I hear it in the perfection of great musical compositions. This spectacular universe knows what it's doing. He also told me the definition of love you gave him when you were 14. Great one, by the way. But said you'd missed something. He said love is the willingness to put the happiness and evolution of the person you love before your own, even if it means giving them up. Time for brutal truth. I always knew you wanted us both. Stop sweating it, wild thing. I'm only one of the many twists and turns of your evolution. I'm getting tired now. It won't be long. I want a rest, so I can make love to you again tonight when you get home. The way you look at me in bed, with all that fierce emotion blazing from your eyes, the way you touch me. You're not big on words, but I feel it in your hands. And because of you, I've gotten to be the man I always wanted to be in this lifetime. Danny, my bodacious, magnificent red thread. You rocked me fucking world. You rattled my existence. You woke me up to shades of life I'd never seen before. I think sometimes we don't get to see our red threads for a dozen or more lifetimes. I hope other times we get 100 lives together, back to back. I can't wait for the chance to love you again. But it's not my turn now. That privilege belongs to someone else. I love you like pie. Dancer.
I dropped my head in my hands and wept. 30. All these things made me who I am. When I decide to box something, I don't fail. I did now. I sat at the table, staring out at the night beyond the windows, remembering Dancer. The first time I'd met him, each and every time after. The times he'd vanish for days, then I'd find him again, and we'd be so bloody happy to see each other, and crack ourselves up, and play with the pure wild abandon of teens in a world that had no rules, except those we made for ourselves. No one to tell us when to sleep or wake, what to eat, what not to eat. No one to tell us how to live. We'd learned from each other. We'd set off bombs and investigated mysteries. He'd invented things for me, given me a bracelet I'd lost Silverside, and I'd shown him my zany, expeditious velocity world. We'd watched cartoons, played at being Pinky in the Brain. Other times, I'd been Tasmanian Devil with him, or the Roadrunner, whizzing us around our town, twisting and carving and embedding our initials into everything. We'd grown up and tackled even more important mysteries, saving the world together, falling in love. I'd gotten his not-so-subtle message. We have more than one red thread. And those threads aren't gender or even species-specific. At least, not in my case. Some of them are romantic, some of them aren't. Max, one of my threads. Our lives inextricably intertwined. I think Mac and Christian also have a red thread. Their interactions not always easy, but definitely transformative. Shazam is one of my threads too. I think Kat maybe as well. We have things to learn from each other. She with her enormous empathy, and me with my formidable walls. Rowena was a great, big, nasty thread, but not a red one. I think people can invade your life and tangle themselves around you, a black rope, and if you create too much bad karma together, maybe they become one of your red threads in a next life. And ever after, until you get whatever you're supposed to learn from your involvement with them. These people who force their way in and wreck your world. Perhaps it's a lesson in some kind of cosmic forgiveness. I haven't learned it yet. I don't forgive her. She was one crazy bitch, and I still don't know everything she did to me. Riordan is one of my red threads too. He might be a massive red rope, 10 times as thick as a normal thread. I'm afraid Dancer saw that. Love is funny. Even though you don't have that person anymore, you still have the feeling. You didn't lose your love. You lost the tangible, tactile, sensational ability to experience the person or animal you lost. Grief is all about not being able to touch anymore. Not being able to use your senses to experience them on a physical level. They've moved beyond an impenetrable veil, beyond your hands and mouth and eyes. And, of course, that led me to another thought I tried to box and failed. I was losing my ability to touch everything. I recognize rabbit holes when I see them. That was a long, bottomless one. I pushed myself up briskly, refusing to tumble over that edge. It was what it was, period. Patterns, meaning, not my forte. Action, swift and sure, I get that. I glanced at my phone for the time, grabbed my sword, shoved it over my shoulder into the sheath, and turned to the bedroom to freshen up and head for Chester's. If I didn't hustle, he'd be hammering on my door. The one who'd been willing to make Dancer one of the 9 for me. I had a brief flash of the two of them sitting together, talking about me. Riordan offering to save Dancer. Dancer knowing I wanted them both. Holy hell. Complicated relationships. My life is full of them. As I entered my dark bedroom and moved for the bathroom to brush my teeth and wash my face, I felt it. There was a living presence in my room, lurking, seething, oozing darkly in the corner behind me. Not Faye. Enormous malevolence. Terrifying. I pivoted sharply. It hulked in the corner to the right of my bed, filling it up, cramming it with darkness heaped upon darkness. No, it crouched, making itself much smaller than it actually was, voracious and suffocatingly evil. My sword was in my right hand instantly, my left bare, upraised. "Show yourself," I snarled. It glided forward from the dense inky shadow it had woven around itself, and as its human-seeming form appeared, bit by bit, head last, I realized it was removing a mask from its face. I have a theory about people I suspect is universal. When someone conceals something from you, it makes you want to see it. The moment the mask cleared that side of its face, I stared, and was instantly ensnared by its terrible gaze. There are rules in this world that you only learn by violating. Some things you can never talk to, like the fear Dorcha, who can steal a piece of your body if you're that kind of fool. The bastard took my mouth once, left me unable to tell the world the many brilliant things I had to say. Mac saved me from him. And now, in addition to unseely princes, I learned there are other things you can never lock gazes with. The moment my eyes met the bottomless, wet, suffocating, mist-filled gaze of the single enormous eye this creature had been concealing behind its mask, I was rooted to the ground, unable to move. No possibility of kicking up into the slipstream. That evil, consuming eye speared a piece of me and locked onto it with savage barbs that wouldn't let go. I felt it enter my mind then. Not like Raiden, with a subtle dip, but a ruthless javelin, with a shiny fish hook on the end that had multiple prongs as it ripped into the very meat of me, yanking, pulling, wrenching something from my body. And I knew in that moment, bloody hell, I knew for a fact that I had a soul, because that's what it was taking from me. The very essence of Danny O'Malley was caught on its lethal barb. The building blocks of all that I am. My strength and power, my truths and lies, my heart and brain and fabric and energy, my subconscious, my conscious, my id and ego, my entire personality was being extracted on the hooked end of its javelin. I was losing everything that was me. It was scraping me like a mussel from a shell to devour me, absorb my strengths and abilities, and once it had me, I would never exist again. It was death, so final, it was beyond my comprehension. This thing, whatever it was, trafficked in obliteration of the human soul. End of all adventures permanently. End of all red threads. There is no greater abomination in my universe. I don't fear death. I resent the fuck out of it. I don't like commercial breaks in my programming, but I don't fear it. Because I know I'm a permanent, indelible, massive, fat-tipped Sherpy. I can't be scrubbed out of the cosmos. But this thing defied all the rules. It could erase me forever. As it continued to rip me from my body, dragging me into its wet, suffocating mist, swallowing me whole, I caught a glimpse of the horror of it, the horror of what it contained. Tens of thousands of souls like mine, becoming more powerful with each it stole. Tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 souls, screaming with panic and madness, existing in a formless half-life, as fuel for something that was erasing every shred of their individuality, moulding them into a formless lump of its own will, blotting them out of existence bit by torturous bit, and they were aware of being destroyed. I caught a vision then, within its dark mind, of bodies shambling like zombies, controlled by it. It despised them, barely kept them alive, made them fight like dogs for scraps of food, tormented them endlessly, laughing as they mindlessly did its bidding. It not only grew ever more powerful with each soul, but was amassing an army of humans. Slaves, countless human souls destroyed. This thing had been taking my adults. This was the him on the other side of those narrow black mirrors, reeking of wood smoke and blood. But more. So much more. All over Western Europe it had been culling humans, growing in power, pursuing its dark agenda, which was, oh holy hell, the obliteration of the entire human race. It wanted us dead, gone, forever eradicated, never to return. It hated us beyond reason. It planned to turn its army of humans against us, then against the Fae, and with my sword, it had a damned good chance at wiping both races out. Even more horrifying, it believed once it acquired a certain number of souls, it would be so powerful its demonic eye would no longer be necessary. It would only have to stroll through a city and inhale every human soul in it, its deadly reach expanding wider with each new acquisition.
I was right about you.
It purred.
You are worth 100 of them.
I scowled. Surely more than that. Its mocking laughter echoed inside my soul. It found me arrogant. It hungered to eat me, become me, assimilate me, steal everything I'd worked so hard to become. With enormous effort, I made a box and deposited myself within it. I ended up with less than half of me inside. It had the other half.
Battle is futile. I existed long before your puny race came along, and will exist long after you are gone.
It yanked savagely. I stretched long and painfully thin, dug mental feet beneath the rim of my box. I needed a name, damn it. I wasn't leaving without one, and I would be leaving. Who are you?
God. Death. Soul Stealer.
But I caught a name beneath it, deep beneath. It was proud, far more arrogant than me. It wanted its name said, over and over. It commanded its soulless army to repeat an endless chant, worshipping it. That was the indecipherable chant I'd heard through those dark mirrors. Baylor. It was a place to start. I instantly embraced the hunter's darkness within, encouraged it to explode inside me, slam into my brain, back down to my heart, then raised both hands and flung them at it.
How are you moving?
Baylor screamed. I released bolt after bolt of pale blue. Holy hell, where was I? Rocketing through a wormhole, achieving superluminal velocity faster than I'd ever managed in my slipstream, exploding into open space, drawing to a sudden complete halt in the middle of a circle of hunters.
She comes.
They gonged.
It's time.
I hovered there, feeling as if I stood in a doorway. One land behind me, one land ahead. Both fascinating, both real, and all I had to do was lift my foot and take a step either way. And for a split second, I hungered to go forward, not back, to feel great black hunter wings churning ice as I soared, exploring the mysteries of the universe. No door barred to me. To be so bloody powerful and untamed and wild and free. The biggest bad in the universe. Owning the skies, tasting of stardust and eternity. And it felt oddly as if I belonged there. As if my destiny was writ in these very stars. But my people. No, it's not time, I roared, resisting with every ounce of my will. My world needs me. Then I was rocketing back through that wormhole at a dizzying speed, and I was in the room with Baylor, and my beautiful pale blue lightning was exploding, not only from my hands, but my body, crackling out in powerful bursts, jolting the god again and again. And Baylor was roaring inside my head, screaming with pain. Then he was buckling in the corner, doubling over, clutching his leg, and he whipped his head back and roared at me, as if insulted beyond enduring.
You wounded my fucking leg!
I gathered myself to hurl a bolt straight into his face. Baylor dropped his mask over his eye and exploded into a cloud of misty, damp, black dust that smelled of coffin linings and the sterile chemicals of autopsy rooms and morgues, so cloying and suffocating that I couldn't breathe. Abruptly, he was gone. I tried to whirl and scan the room, in case he'd circled back for another attack. But I had no sense of space. Couldn't comprehend myself in relationship to it. My strength was decimated, both from the tug of war over my soul and the staggering high voltage still sparking beneath my skin. I drew a ragged breath, then another, trying desperately to center myself. I raised a foot to take a step, but when I brought it down, it didn't feel solid. I stumbled and went crashing to the floor, cracking my head on the corner of the bed frame. Everything went black. Vigilante. Rowena was in my life long before I met her at 8. After the rejection of Seamus, a man my mother deeply loved, a man who might have been our savior. She fell apart. Her heart had taken too many blows. While my mother was defeated by grief, and out of work, thanks to Seamus's spineless, vindictive way of erasing her from its life, Rowena dispatched the man who had become her pimp. Feigning love, the bastard began his endless manipulations, treating her at first better, then finally worse than anyone ever had. By then, pain and despair had become Emma O'Malley's normal. She expected to be abused by life. Rowena sent the next boyfriend too, an aficionado of drugs, to introduce her to the only escape she would ever know, besides death. Her sadistic plan? To subject me to even more pain and suffering. To burn my world down around me as I watched, helpless, to char me beyond repair. To see what rose from the ashes. To step in as my savior and rescue me from my cage, hoping for a broken, malleable weapon. One that would despise herself for the darkness within. One so deeply fractured, she would grovel for crumbs of kindness, despite the many superpowers that made her infinitely more powerful than Rowena herself. Her plan worked. I broke. But I scarred stronger. When she found me wandering Dublin at 8, and realized things hadn't unfolded according to her careful plan, she used black arts to tamper with my mind, burying the real one beneath a false memory of her discovering me, rescuing me from my cage as I lay waiting to die. Like any good liar, she salted her lie with grains of truth. Let me continue to believe I killed my mother by strangling her through the bars. She wanted me tormented by the blade of matricide. Silverside, I meticulously ferreted out her spells and compulsions. I didn't get rid of my demons. I don't think that's possible for me. But I know them by name now. And they obey me, not the other way around. After I moved into the Abbey, even before I knew the extent of Rowena's involvement in our lives, I had a dream that I killed her. Later, when I discovered all she'd done to us, I had that dream again. I'd hungered to kill her. I told myself the only reason I didn't was because the other she-seers would have ostracized me, and I'd wanted desperately to belong. I wouldn't have felt an ounce of regret. Rabid animals need to be put down. My anger would definitely have ebbed. But there was a deeper reason that gave me pause. Both times, as she lay dying in my dreams, I'd seen a flash of pure evil triumph glittering in that sadistic blue gaze. Glee. Gloating. Jubilation. Her eyes had said, "You are an animal. You are a monster. You are damaged beyond repair. I did that to you, and I may be dying, but I took you down with me. I may go to hell, but you'll live in it every day for the rest of your life. I shattered you, and you will never be anything but a creature of impulsive reactions, a killer of innocence. You are as ugly and corrupt as me." I'm glad Matt killed her. I never wanted to give her the opportunity to look at me that way, or feel she had a single reason to gloat. Because I know a priceless truth. When someone has done everything in their power to mangle your wings beyond recognition, to slice them to shreds so that they can never be used, there is only one way to win. Fly. Rising. What the caterpillar calls the end of the world, the master calls a butterfly. Richard Bach. 31. Live without your sunlight. Love without your heartbeat.